And be no doubt that the church would look upon the criminal and the crime of the future in many cases quite differently, and would succeed in restoring the excluded, in restraining those who plan evil, and in regenerating the fallen. It is true, said Father Zossima with a smile, the Christian society now is not ready, and is only resting on some seven righteous men. But as they are never lacking, it will continue still unshaken, in expectation of its complete transformation from a society almost heathen in character, into a single, universal, and all-powerful church. So be it. So be it. Even though, at the end of the ages, for it is ordained to come to pass, and there is no need to be troubled about times and seasons, for the secret of the times and seasons is in the wisdom of God, in his foresight, and his love. And what, in human reckoning, seems still afar off, may by the divine ordinance be close at hand, on the eve of its appearance. And so be it, so be it. So be it, so be it. Father Paisi repeated austerely and reverently. "Strange, extremely strange," Miusov pronounced, not so much with heat as with latent indignation.
"What strikes you as so strange?"
Father Yosef inquired cautiously.
"Why, it's beyond anything," cried Miusov, suddenly breaking out. "The state is eliminated, and the church is raised to the position of the state. It's not simply ultramontanism, it's arch-ultramontanism. It's beyond the dreams of Pope Gregory the Seventh."
"You are completely misunderstanding it," said Father Paisi sternly. "Understand that the church is not to be transformed into the state. That is Rome and its dream. That is the third temptation of the devil. On the contrary, the state is transformed into the church, will ascend and become a church over the whole world, which is the complete opposite of ultramontanism and Rome, and your interpretation, and is only the glorious destiny ordained for the Orthodox Church. This star will arise in the east." Miusov was significantly silent. His whole figure expressed extraordinary personal dignity. A supercilious and condescending smile played on his lips. Alyosha watched it all with a throbbing heart. The whole conversation stirred him profoundly. He glanced casually at Rakitin, who was standing immovable in his place by the door, listening and watching intently, though with downcast eyes. But from the colour in his cheeks, Alyosha guessed that Rakitin was probably no less excited, and he knew what caused his excitement.
"Allow me to tell you one little anecdote, gentlemen,"
Miusov said impressively, with a peculiarly majestic air.
"Some years ago, soon after the coup d'etat of December, I happened to be calling in Paris on an extremely influential personage in the government, and I met a very interesting man in his house. This individual was not precisely a detective, but was a sort of superintendent of a whole regiment of political detectives, a rather powerful position in its own way. I was prompted by curiosity to seize the opportunity of conversation with him. And as he had not come as a visitor, but as a subordinate official bringing a special report, and as he saw the reception given me by his chief, he deigned to speak with some openness, to a certain extent only, of course. He was rather courteous than open, as Frenchmen know how to be courteous, especially to a foreigner. But I thoroughly understood him. The subject was the socialist revolutionaries, who were at that time persecuted. I will quote only one most curious remark dropped by this person. 'We are not particularly afraid,' said he, 'of all these socialists, anarchists, infidels, and revolutionists. We keep watch on them and know all their goings-on, but there are a few peculiar men among them who believe in God and are Christians, but at the same time are socialists. Those are the people we are most afraid of. They are dreadful people. The socialist who is a Christian is more to be dreaded than a socialist who is an atheist.' Words struck me at the time, and now they've suddenly come back to me here, gentlemen."
"You apply them to us and look upon us as socialists?"
Father Paisi asked directly without beating about the bush. But before Pyotr Alexandrovich could think what to answer, the door opened, and the guest, so long expected, Dmitri Fyodorovich, came in. They had, in fact, given up expecting him, and his sudden appearance caused some surprise for a moment. I went back to the window to the master and said, "She's here, she's come. Agrafena Alexandrovna has come, wants to be let in." And he started like a baby. "Where is she?" he fairly gasped, but couldn't believe it. "She's standing there," said I. "Open." He looked out of the window at me, half believing and half distrustful, but afraid to open. Why is he afraid of me now? I thought, and it was funny. I bethought me to knock on the window frame, those taps we'd agreed upon as a signal that Grushenka had come in his presence before his eyes. He didn't seem to believe my words, but as soon as he heard the taps, he ran at once to open the door. He opened it. I would have gone in, but he stood in the way to prevent me passing. "Where is she? Where is she?" He looked at me all of a tremble. Well, thought I, if he's so frightened of me as all that, it's a bad lookout. And my legs went weak with fright that he wouldn't let me in or would call up, or Marfa Ignatyevna would run up or something else might happen. I don't remember now, but I must have stood pale facing him. I whispered to him, "Why, she's there, under the window. How is it you don't see her?" I said. "Bring her, then, bring her." "She's afraid," said I. "She was frightened at the noise. She's hidden in the bushes. Go and call to her yourself from the study." He ran to the window, put the candle in the window. "Grushenka," he cried, "Grushenka, are you here?" Though he cried that, he didn't want to lean out of the window. He didn't want to move away from me, for he was panic-stricken. He was so frightened he didn't dare to turn his back on me. "Why, here she is," said I. I went up to the window and leaned right out of it. "Here she is, she's in the bush laughing you, don't you see her?" He suddenly believed it. He was all of a shake. He was awfully crazy about her, and he leaned right out of the window. I snatched up that iron paperweight from his table, do you remember, weighing about 3 pounds. I swung it and hit him on the top of the skull with the corner of it. He didn't even cry out. He only sank down suddenly, and I hit him again and a third time. And the third time I knew I'd broken his skull, he suddenly rolled on his back, face upwards, covered with blood. I looked round. There was no blood on me, not a spot. I wiped the paperweight, put it back, went up to the icons, took the money out of the envelope and flung the envelope on the floor and the pink ribbon beside it. I went out into the garden, all of a tremble, straight to the apple tree with a hollow in it. You know that hollow? I'd marked it long before and put a rag and a piece of paper ready in it. I wrapped all the notes in the rag and stuffed it deep down in the hole, and there it stayed for over a fortnight. I took it out later when I came out of the hospital. I went back to my bed, lay down, and thought, if Grigory Vasilievich has been killed outright, it may be a bad job for me, but if he's not killed and recovers, it'll be first rate, for then he'll be a witness that Dmitri Fyodorovich had been here, and so he must have killed him and taken the money. Then I began groaning with suspense and impatience, so as to wake Marfa Ignatyevna as soon as possible. At last she got up and she rushed to me, but when she saw Grigory Vasilievich was not there, she ran out and I heard her scream in the garden. And that set it all going and set my mind at rest. He stopped. Ivan had listened all the time in dead silence without stirring or taking his eyes off him. As he told his story, Smerdyakov glanced at him from time to time, but for the most part kept his eyes averted. When he'd finished, he was evidently agitated and was breathing hard. The perspiration stood out in his face, but it was impossible to tell whether it was remorse he was feeling or what. "Stay," cried Ivan, pondering. "What about the door? If he only opened the door to you, how could Grigory have seen it open before? For Grigory saw it before you went." It was remarkable that Ivan spoke quite amicably in a different tone, not angry as before. So if anyone had opened the door at that moment and peeped in at them, he would certainly have concluded that they were talking peaceably about some ordinary, though interesting, subject. As for that door and Grigory Vasilievich's having seen it open, that's only his fancy, said Smerdyakov with a wry smile. He's not a man, I assure you, but an obstinate mule. He didn't see it, but he fancied he'd seen it, and there's no shaking him.
It's just our luck he took that notion into his head, for they can't fail to convict Dmitri Fyodorovich after that. Listen, said Ivan, beginning to seem bewildered again and making an effort to grasp something. Listen, there are a lot of questions I want to ask you, but I forget them. I keep forgetting and getting mixed up. Yes, tell me this at least. Why did you open the envelope and leave it there on the floor? Why didn't you simply carry off the envelope? When you were telling me, I thought you spoke about it as though it were the right thing to do. But why? I can't understand. I did that for a good reason. For if a man had known all about it, as I did, for instance, if he'd seen those notes before and perhaps had put them in that envelope himself, and had seen the envelope sealed up and addressed with his own eyes, if such a man had done the murder, what should have made him tear open the envelope afterwards, especially in such desperate haste, since he'd know for certain the notes must be in the envelope? No, if the robber had been someone like me, he'd simply have put the envelope straight in his pocket and got away with it as fast as he could. But it'd be quite different with Dmitri Fyodorovich. He only knew about the envelope by hearsay. He'd never seen it. And if he'd found it, for instance, under the mattress, he'd have torn it open as quickly as possible to make sure the notes were in it. And he'd have thrown the envelope down without having time to think that it would be evidence against him. "'Because he was not an habitual thief and had never directly stolen anything before, "'for he is a gentleman born, "'and if he did bring himself to steal, it would not be regular stealing, "'but simply taking what was his own, for he told the whole town he meant to before, "'and had even bragged aloud before everyone that he'd go and take his property from Fyodor Pavlovich. "'I didn't say that openly to the prosecutor when I was being examined, but quite the contrary. "'I brought him to it by a hint as though I didn't see it myself.' "'and as though he thought of it himself, and I hadn't prompted him, "'so that Mr. Prosecutor's mouth positively watered at my suggestion. "'But can you possibly have thought of all that on the spot?' cried Ivan, overcome with astonishment. "'He looked at Smerdyakov again with alarm. "'Mercy on us, could anyone think of it all in such a desperate hurry? "'It was all thought out beforehand. "'Well, it was the devil helped you.' Ivan cried again. No, you're not a fool. You're far cleverer than I thought. He got up, obviously intending to walk across the room. He was in terrible distress. But as the table blocked his way and there was hardly room to pass between the table and the wall, he only turned round where he stood and sat down again. Perhaps the impossibility of moving irritated him as he suddenly cried out almost as furiously as before. Listen, you miserable, contemptible creature! "'Don't you understand that if I haven't killed you, "'it's simply because I'm keeping you to answer tomorrow at the trial? "'God sees!' "'Ivan raised his hand. "'Perhaps I too was guilty. "'Perhaps I really had a secret desire for my father's death. "'But I swear I was not as guilty as you think, "'and perhaps I didn't urge you on at all. "'No, I didn't urge you on. "'But no matter, I will give evidence against myself tomorrow at the trial. "'I'm determined to. "'I shall tell everything, everything.' "'But we'll make our appearance together, "'and whatever you may say against me at the trial, "'whatever evidence you give, "'I'll face it, I'm not afraid of you. "'I'll confirm it all myself. "'But you must confess too, you must. "'You must, we'll go together. "'That's how it shall be.'
"'Ivan said this solemnly and resolutely, "'and from his flashing eyes alone "'it could be seen that it would be so. "'You're ill, I see, you're quite ill, "'your eyes are yellow,' "'Smerdyakov commented without the least irony, "'with apparent sympathy, in fact.'
"'We'll go together,' Ivan repeated. "'And if you won't go, no matter, I'll go alone.'
Smerdyakov paused as though pondering.
"'There'll be nothing of the sort, and you won't go,' he concluded at last positively. "'You don't understand me,'
Ivan exclaimed reproachfully. "'You'll be too much ashamed if you confess it all. "'And what's more, it'd be no use at all, for I shall say straight out "'that I had never said anything of the sort to you, "'and that you're either ill, and it looks like it too, "'or that you're so sorry for your brother "'that you're sacrificing yourself to save him "'and have invented it all against me, "'for you've always thought no more of me than if I'd been a fly. "'And who will believe you, and what single proof have you got? "'Listen, you just showed me those notes, just now, to convince me.' Smerdyakov lifted the book off the notes and laid it on one side.
"'Take that money away with you,'
Smerdyakov sighed.
"'Of course I shall take it. Why do you give it to me if you committed the murder for the sake of it?'
Ivan looked at him with great surprise. I don't want it, Smerdyakov articulated in a shaking voice, with a gesture of refusal. I did have an idea of beginning a new life with that money in Moscow, or, better still, abroad. I did dream of it chiefly because all things are lawful. That was quite right what you taught me, for you talked a lot to me about that. For if there's no everlasting God, there's no such thing as virtue, and there's no need of it. You were right there, so that's how I looked at it. Did you come to that of yourself? Asked Ivan with a wry smile. With your guidance. And now I suppose you believe in God since you're giving back the money.
No, I don't believe, whispered Smerdyakov.
Then why are you giving it back?
Leave off. That's enough.
Smerdyakov waved his hand again. You used to say yourself that everything was lawful, so now why are you so upset too? You even want to go and give evidence against yourself.
Only there'd be nothing this sort. You won't go to give evidence,
Smerdyakov decided with conviction.
You'll see,
said Ivan. It isn't possible. You're very clever. You're fond of money. I know that. You like to be respected, too, for you're very proud. You're far too fond of female charms, too. And you mind most of all about living in undisturbed comfort without having to depend on anyone. That's what you care most about. You don't want to spoil your life forever by taking such a disgrace on yourself. You're like Fyodor Pavlovich. You're more like him than any of his children. You've the same soul as he had.
You're not a fool,
said Ivan, seeming struck. The blood rushed to his face.
You're serious now,
he observed, looking suddenly at Smerdyakov with a different expression.
It was your pride, mate. You'd think I was a fool. Take the money.
Ivan took the three rolls of notes and put them in his pocket without wrapping them in anything.
I shall show them at the court tomorrow, he said.
Nobody will believe you, as you've plenty of money of your own. You may simply have taken it out of your cash box and brought it to the court.
Ivan rose from his seat.
I repeat, he said, the only reason I haven't killed you is that I need you for tomorrow, and remember that. Don't forget it.
Well, kill me. Kill me now,
Smerdyakov said, all at once looking strangely at Ivan.
You wouldn't dare do that, even,
he added with a bitter smile.
You won't dare to do anything, you, who used to be so bold.
Till tomorrow,
cried Ivan, and moved to go out.
Stay a moment. Show me those notes again.
Ivan took out the notes and showed them to him. Smerdyakov looked at them for 10 seconds.
Well, you can go,
he said with a wave of his hand. Ivan Fyodorovich, he called out after him again.
What do you want?
Ivan turned without stopping. Goodbye.
Till tomorrow,
Ivan cried again, and he walked out of the cottage. The snowstorm was still raging. He walked the first few steps boldly, but suddenly began staggering.
It's something physical,
he thought with a grin. Something like joy was springing up in his heart. He was conscious of unbounded resolution. He would make an end of the wavering that had so tortured him of late. His determination was taken.
And now it will not be changed, he thought with relief.
At that moment he stumbled against something and almost fell down, stopping short. He made out at his feet the peasant he'd knocked down, still lying senseless and motionless. The snow had almost covered his face. Ivan seized him and lifted him to his arms. Seeing a light in the little house to the right, he went up, knocked at the shutters, and asked the man to whom the house belonged to help him carry the peasant to the police station, promising him 3 rubles. The man got ready and came out. I won't describe in detail how Ivan succeeded in his object, bringing the peasant to the police station and arranging for a doctor to see him at once, providing with a liberal hand for the expenses. I will only say that this business took a whole hour, but Ivan was well content with it. His mind wandered and worked incessantly. If I had not taken my decision so firmly for tomorrow, he reflected with satisfaction, I should not have stayed a whole hour to look after the peasant, but should have passed by without caring about his being frozen. I'm quite capable of watching myself, by the way, he thought at the same instant with still greater satisfaction, although they have decided that I'm going out of my mind." Just as he reached his own house, he stopped short, asking himself suddenly, hadn't he better go at once now to the prosecutor and tell him everything? He decided the question by turning back to the house. "Everything together tomorrow," he whispered to himself, and strange to say, almost all his gladness and self-satisfaction passed in one instant. As he entered his own room, he felt something like a touch of ice on his heart, like a recollection, or more exactly, a reminder of something agonizing and revolting that was in that room now, at that moment, and had been there before. He sank wearily on his sofa. The old woman brought him a samovar. He made tea, but did not touch it. He sat on the sofa and felt guilty. He felt that he was ill and helpless. He was beginning to drop asleep, but he got up uneasily and walked across the room to shake off his drowsiness. At moments he fancied he was delirious, but it was not illness that he thought of most. Sitting down again, he began looking round as though searching for something. This happened several times. At last his eyes were fastened intently on one point. Ivan smiled, but an angry flush suffused his face. He sat a long time in his place, his head propped on both arms, though he looked sideways at the same point, at the sofa that stood against the opposite wall. There was evidently something, some object, that irritated him there, worried him and tormented him. Chapter 9. The Devil. Ivan's Nightmare. I'm not a doctor, but yet I feel that the moment has come when I must inevitably give the reader some account of the nature of Ivan's illness. Anticipating events, I can say at least one thing. He was at that moment on the very eve of an attack of brain fever. Though his health had long been affected, it had offered a stubborn resistance to the fever, which in the end gained complete mastery over it. Though I know nothing of medicine, I venture to hazard the suggestion that he really had, perhaps, by a terrible effort of will, succeeded in delaying the attack for a time, hoping, of course, to check it completely. He knew that he was unwell, but he loathed the thought of being ill at that fatal time, at the approaching crisis in his life, when he needed to have all his wits about him to say what he had to say boldly and resolutely and to justify himself to himself. He had, however, consulted the new doctor, who had been brought from Moscow by a fantastic notion of Katerina Ivanovna's, to which I have referred already. After listening to him and examining him, the doctor came to the conclusion that he was actually suffering from some disorder of the brain, and was not at all surprised by an admission which Ivan had reluctantly made him.
"Hallucinations are quite likely in your condition," the doctor opined, "though it would be better to verify them. You must take steps at once, without a moment's delay, or things will go badly with you."
But Ivan did not follow this judicious advice, and did not take to his bed to be nursed.
"I'm walking about, so I'm strong enough. If I drop, it'll be different then. Anyone may nurse me who likes,"
he decided, dismissing the subject. And so he was sitting, almost conscious himself of his delirium, and, as I've said already, looking persistently at some object on the sofa against the opposite wall. Someone appeared to be sitting there, though goodness knows how he had come in, for he'd not been in the room when Ivan came into it on his return from Smerdyakov. This was a person, or more accurately speaking, a Russian gentleman of a particular kind. No longer young, qui faisait la cinquantaine, as the French say, with rather long, still thick, dark hair, slightly streaked with grey, and a small pointed beard. He was wearing a brownish reefer jacket, rather shabby, evidently made by a good tailor, though, and of a fashion at least 3 years old that had been discarded by smart and well-to-do people for the last 2 years. His linen and his long, scarf-like necktie were all such as are worn by people who aim at being stylish, but on closer inspection his linen was not over clean and his wide scarf was very threadbare. The visitor's check trousers were of excellent cut, but were too light in colour and too tight for the present fashion. His soft, fluffy white hat was out of keeping with the season. In brief, there was every appearance of gentility on straightened means.
It looked as though the gentleman belonged to that class of idle landowners who used to flourish in the times of serfdom. He had unmistakably been at some time in good and fashionable society, had once had good connections, had possibly preserved them indeed, but after a gay youth, becoming gradually impoverished on the abolition of serfdom, he had sunk into the position of a poor relation of the best class, wandering from one good old friend to another, and received by them for his companionable and accommodating disposition, and as being, after all, a gentleman who could be asked to sit down with anyone, though, of course, not in a place of honour. Such gentlemen of accommodating temper and dependent position, who can tell a story, take a hand at cards, and who have a distinct aversion for any duties that may be forced upon them, are usually solitary creatures, either bachelors or widowers. Sometimes they have children, but if so, the children are always being brought up at a distance, at some aunt's, to whom these gentlemen never allude in good society, seeming ashamed of the relationship. They gradually lose sight of their children altogether, though at intervals they receive a birthday or Christmas letter from them, and sometimes even answer it. The countenance of the unexpected visitor was not so much good nature as accommodating and ready to assume any amiable expression as occasion might arise. He had no watch, but he had a tortoise-shell lorgnette on a black ribbon. On the middle finger of his right hand was a massive gold ring with a cheap opal stone in it. Ivan was angrily silent and would not begin the conversation. The visitor waited and sat exactly like a poor relation who had come down from his room to keep his host company at tea, and was discreetly silent, seeing that his host was frowning and preoccupied. But he was ready for any affable conversation as soon as his host should begin it. All at once his face expressed a sudden solicitude. "I say," he began to Ivan, "excuse me, I only mention it to remind you. You went to Smerdyakov's to find out about Katerina Ivanovna, but you came away without finding out anything about her. You probably forgot."
"Ah, yes," broke from Ivan, and his face grew gloomy with uneasiness. "Yes, I'd forgotten, but it doesn't matter now. Never mind, till tomorrow," he muttered to himself. "And you," he added, addressing his visitor, "I should have remembered that myself in a minute, for that was just what was tormenting me. Why do you interfere, as if I should believe that you prompted me and that I didn't remember it of myself?"
"Don't believe it, then," said the gentleman, smiling amicably. "What's the good of believing against your will? Besides, proofs are no help to believing, especially material proofs. Thomas believed not because he saw Christ risen, but because he wanted to believe before he saw. Look at the spiritualists, for instance. I'm very fond of them. Only fancy, they imagine that they're serving the cause of religion, because the devils show them their horns from the other world. That, they say, is a material proof, so to speak, of the existence of another world. The other world and material proofs, what next? And if you come to that, does proving there's a devil prove that there's a God? I want to join an idealist society. I'll lead the opposition in it. I'll say I'm a realist, but not a materialist.
Listen." Ivan suddenly got up from the table. "I seem to be delirious. I am delirious, in fact. Talk any nonsense you like, I don't care. You won't drive me to fury as you did last time. But I feel somehow ashamed. I want to walk about the room. I sometimes don't see you and don't even hear your voice as I did last time. But I always guess what you're prating, for it's I myself speaking, not you. Only I don't know whether I was dreaming last time or whether I really saw you. I'll wet a towel and put it on my head and perhaps you'll vanish into air." Ivan went into the corner, took a towel and did as he said, and with a wet towel on his head began walking up and down the room.
"I'm so glad you treat me so familiarly," the visitor began.
"Fool," laughed Ivan. "Do you suppose I should stand on ceremony with you? I'm in good spirits now, though I have a pain in my forehead, and in the top of my head. Only please don't talk philosophy as you did last time. If you can't take yourself off,
Talk of something amusing. Talk gossip. You're a poor relation. You ought to talk gossip. What a nightmare to have. But I'm not afraid of you. I'll get the better of you. I won't be taken to a madhouse.
C'est charmant. Poor relation. Yes. I am in my natural shape. For what am I on earth but a poor relation? By the way, I am listening to you and am rather surprised to find you're actually beginning to take me for something real. Not simply your fancy, as you persisted in declaring last time.
Never for 1 minute have I taken you for reality,
Ivan cried with a sort of fury.
You're a lie, you are my illness, you are a phantom. It's only that I don't know how to destroy you, and I see I must suffer for a time. You are my hallucination, you are the incarnation of myself, but only of one side of me, of my thoughts and feelings, but only the nastiest and stupidest of them. From that point of view, you might be of interest to me if only I had time to waste on you.
Excuse me, I'll catch you. When you flew out at Alyosha under the lamppost this evening and shouted to him, you learnt it from him. How do you know that he visits me? You were thinking of me then. So for one brief moment you did believe that I really exist.
The gentleman laughed blandly.
Yes, that was a moment of weakness, but I couldn't believe in you. I don't know whether I was asleep or awake last time. Perhaps I was only dreaming then and didn't see you really at all.
And why were you so surly with Alyosha just now? He is a dear. I've treated him badly over Father Zosima.
Don't talk of Alyosha. How dare you, you flunky!
Ivan laughed again.
You scold me, but you laugh. That's a good sign. But you're ever so much more polite than you were last time, and I know why. That great resolution of yours.
Don't speak of my resolution,
cried Ivan savagely.
I understand, c'est noble, c'est charmant. You're going to defend your brother and to sacrifice yourself. C'est chevaleresque.
Hold your tongue, I'll kick you.
I shan't be altogether sorry. But then my object will be attained. If you kick me, you must believe in my reality, for people don't kick ghosts. Joking apart, it doesn't matter to me. Scold, if you like, though it's better to be a trifle more polite even to me. Fool, flunky, what words.
Scolding you, I scold myself.
Ivan laughed again.
You are myself, myself only with a different face. You just say what I'm thinking, and are incapable of saying anything new.
If I am like you in my way of thinking, it's all to my credit,
the gentleman declared with delicacy and dignity.
You choose out only my worst thoughts, and what's more, the stupid ones. You are stupid and vulgar, awfully stupid. No, I can't put up with you. What am I to do? What am I to do?
Ivan said through his clenched teeth.
My dear friend, above all things, I want to behave like a gentleman and to be recognized as such.
The visitor began in an access of deprecating and simple-hearted pride, typical of a poor relation.
I am poor, but I won't say very honest, but it's an axiom generally accepted in society that I am a fallen angel. I certainly can't conceive how I can ever have been an angel. If I ever was, it must have been so long ago that there's no harm in forgetting it. Now I only prize the reputation of being a gentlemanly person and live as I can, trying to make myself agreeable. I love men genuinely. I've been greatly calumniated. Here, when I stay with you from time to time, my life gains a kind of reality. And that's what I like most of all. You see, like you, I suffer from the fantastic. And so I love the realism of Earth. Here, with you, everything is circumscribed. Here, all is formulated and geometrical. While we have nothing but indeterminate equations. I wander about here dreaming. I like dreaming. Besides, on Earth, I become superstitious. Please don't laugh. That's just what I like to become, superstitious. I adopt all your habits here. I've grown fond of going to the public baths, would you believe it? And I go and steam myself with merchants and priests. What I dream of is becoming incarnate once for all, and irrevocably in the form of some merchant's wife weighing 18 stone, and of believing all she believes.
My ideal is to go to church and offer a candle in simple-hearted faith. Upon my word, it is. Then there would be an end to my sufferings. I like being doctored, too. In the spring, there was an outbreak of smallpox, and I went and was vaccinated in a foundling hospital. If only you knew how I enjoyed myself that day. I subscribed 10 rubles to the cause of the Slavs. But you're not listening. Do you know you are not at all well this evening? I know you went yesterday to that doctor. Well, what about your health? What did the doctor say? Fool! Ivan snapped out. But you are clever anyway. You're scolding again? I didn't ask out of sympathy. You needn't answer. Now rheumatism has come in again. Fool! Repeated Ivan. You keep saying the same thing, but I had such an attack of rheumatism last year that I remember it to this day. The devil have rheumatism? Why not, if I sometimes put on fleshly form? I put on fleshly form and I take the consequences. Satan sum et nihil humanum a me alienum puto. What? What? Satan sum et nihil humanum? That's not bad for the devil. I'm glad I pleased you at last. But you didn't get that from me? Ivan stopped suddenly, seeming struck. That never entered my head, that's strange. C'est du nouveau, n'est-ce pas? This time I'll act honestly and explain to you. Listen, in dreams, and especially in nightmares, from indigestion or anything, a man sees sometimes such artistic visions, such complex and real actuality. Such events, even a whole world of events, woven into such a plot, with such unexpected details from the most exalted matters to the last button on a cuff, as I swear Leo Tolstoy has never invented. Yet such dreams are sometimes seen not by writers, but by the most ordinary people, officials, journalists, priests. The subject is a complete enigma. A statesman confessed to me, indeed, that all his best ideas came to him when he was asleep. Well, that's how it is now. Though I am your hallucination, yet, just as in a nightmare, I say original things which had not entered your head before. So, I don't repeat your ideas, yet I am only your nightmare, nothing more. You are lying. Your aim is to convince me you exist apart and are not my nightmare, and now you are asserting you're a dream. My dear fellow, I've adopted a special method today. I'll explain it to you afterwards. Stay, where did I break off? Oh, yes. I caught cold then. Only not here, but yonder. Where is yonder? Tell me, will you be here long? Can't you go away? Ivan exclaimed, almost in despair. He ceased walking to and fro, sat down on the sofa, leaned his elbows on the table again, and held his head tight in both hands. He pulled the wet towel off and flung it away in vexation. It was evidently of no use. "Your nerves are out of order," observed the gentleman with a carelessly easy, though perfectly polite, air. "You are angry with me even for being able to catch cold, though it happened in a most natural way. I was hurrying then to a diplomatic soiree at the house of a lady of high rank in Petersburg, who was aiming at influence in the ministry. Well, an evening suit, white tie, gloves, though I was God knows where and had to fly through space to reach your earth. Of course, it only took an instant, but you know a ray of light from the sun takes full 8 minutes, and fancy in an evening suit and open waistcoat. Spirits don't freeze, but when one's in fleshly form, well, in brief, I didn't think and set off. And you know, in those ethereal spaces, in the water that is above the firmament, there's such a frost. At least, one can't call it frost. You can fancy 150 degrees below zero. You know the game the village girls play? They invite the unwary to lick an axe in 30 degrees of frost. The tongue instantly freezes to it, and the dupe tears the skin off, so it bleeds.
But that's only in 30 degrees. In 150 degrees, I imagine it would be enough to put your finger on the axe, and it would be the end of it. If only there could be an axe there. And can there be an axe there?
Ivan interrupted, carelessly and disdainfully. He was exerting himself to the utmost not to believe in the delusion and not to sink into complete insanity.
An axe?
The guest interrupted in surprise.
Yes. What would become of an axe there?
Ivan cried suddenly with a sort of savage and insistent obstinacy.
What would become of an axe in space? Quelle idée! If it were to fall to any distance, it would begin, I think, flying round the earth without knowing why, like a satellite. The astronomers would calculate the rising and the setting of the axe. Gatsuk would put it in his calendar, that's all.
You are stupid, awfully stupid, said Ivan peevishly. Fib more cleverly, or I won't listen. You want to get the better of me by realism to convince me that you exist. But I don't want to believe you exist. I won't believe it.
But I'm not fibbing. It's all the truth. The truth is unhappily hardly ever amusing. I see you persist in expecting something big of me, and perhaps something fine. That's a great pity, for I only give what I can.
Don't talk philosophy, you ass!
Philosophy, indeed, when all my right side is numb and I'm moaning and groaning. I've tried all the medical faculty. They can diagnose beautifully. They have the whole of your disease at their fingertips, but they've no idea how to cure you. There was an enthusiastic little student here. You may die, said he, but you'll know perfectly well what disease you are dying of. And then, what a way they have of sending people to specialists. We only diagnose, they say, but go to such and such a specialist, he'll cure you. The old doctor who used to cure all sorts of diseases completely disappeared, I assure you. Now there are only specialists, and they all advertise in the newspapers. If anything is wrong with your nose, they send you to Paris. There, they say, is a European specialist who cures noses. If you go to Paris, he'll look at your nose. I can only cure your right nostril, he'll tell you, for I don't cure the left nostril. That's not my speciality. But go to Vienna. There's a specialist who will cure your left nostril. What are you to do? I fell back on popular remedies. A German doctor advised me to rub myself with honey and salt in the bathhouse. Solely to get an extra bath, I went. Smeared myself all over, and it did me no good at all. In despair, I wrote to Count Mattei in Milan. He sent me a book and some drops, bless him, and only fancy, Hoff's malt extract cured me. I bought it by accident, drank a bottle and a half of it, and I was ready to dance. It took it away completely. I made up my mind to write to the papers to thank him. I was prompted by a feeling of gratitude, and only fancy, it led to no end of a bother. Not a single paper would take my letter. It would be very reactionary, they said. No one will believe it. Le diable n'existe point. You'd better remain anonymous, they advised me. What use is a letter or thanks if it's anonymous? I laughed with the men at the newspaper office. It's reactionary to believe in God in our days, I said, but I am the devil, so I may be believed in. We quite understand that, they said. Who doesn't believe in the devil? Yet it won't do. It might injure our reputation. As a joke, if you like. But I thought as a joke it wouldn't be very witty, so it wasn't printed. And you know, I felt sore about it to this day. My best feelings, gratitude, for instance, are literally denied me simply from my social position. Philosophical reflections again, Ivan snarled malignantly. God preserve me from it. But one can't help complaining sometimes. I am a slandered man. You upbraid me every moment with being stupid. One can see you are young. My dear fellow, intelligence isn't the only thing. I've naturally a kind and merry heart. I also write vaudevilles of all sorts. You seem to take me for Felestikov, grown old. But my fate is a far more serious one. Before time was, by some decree, which I can never make out, I was predestined to deny, and yet I'm genuinely good-hearted and not at all inclined to negation. No, you must go and deny. Without denial, there's no criticism, and what would a journal be without a column of criticism? Without criticism, it would be nothing but one hosanna.
But nothing but Hosanna is not enough for life. The Hosanna must be tried in the crucible of doubt and so on, in the same style. But I don't meddle in that. I didn't create it. I'm not answerable for it. Well, they've chosen their scapegoat. They've made me write the column of criticism, and so life was made possible. We understand that comedy. I, for instance, simply ask for annihilation. No, live, I'm told, for there'd be nothing without you. If everything in the universe was sensible, nothing would happen. There would be no events without you, and there must be events. So, against the grain, I serve to produce events and do what's irrational because I'm commanded to. For all their indisputable intelligence, men take this farce as something serious, and that is their tragedy. They suffer, of course, but then they live. They live a real life, not a fantastic one, for suffering is life. Without suffering, what would be the pleasure of it? It would be transformed into an endless church service. It would be holy, but tedious. But what about me? I suffer, but still I don't live. I'm X in an indeterminate equation. I'm a sort of phantom in life who has lost all beginning and end, and who has even forgotten his own name. You're laughing. No, you're not laughing. You're angry again. You're forever angry. All you care about is intelligence. But I repeat again that I would give away all this superstellar life, all the ranks and honours, simply to be transformed into the soul of a merchant's wife weighing 18 stone and set candles at God's shrine. Then even you don't believe in God, said Ivan with a smile of hatred. What can I say? That is, if you are in earnest. Is there a God or not? Ivan cried with the same savage intensity. Ah, then you are in earnest. My dear fellow, upon my word, I don't know. There, I've said it now. You don't know, but you see God. No, you're not someone apart. You are myself. You are I and nothing more. You're rubbish. You're my fancy. Well, if you like. I have the same philosophy as you. That would be true. Je pense, donc je suis. I know that for a fact. All the rest, all these worlds, God and even Satan. All that is not proved, to my mind. Does all that exist of itself? Or is it only an emanation of myself, a logical development of my ego, which alone has existed forever? But I make haste to stop, for I believe you'll be jumping up to beat me directly. You'd better tell me some anecdote, said Ivan miserably. There is an anecdote precisely on our subject, or rather a legend, not an anecdote. You reproach me with unbelief, you see, you say, yet you don't believe. My dear fellow, I'm not the only one like that. We're all in the muddle over there now, and all through your science. Once there used to be atoms, 5 senses, 4 elements, and then everything hung together somehow. There were atoms in the ancient world, even, but since we've learned that you've discovered the chemical molecule and protoplasm and the devil knows what, we had to lower our crest. There's a regular muddle, and above all, superstition, scandal. There's as much scandal among us as among you, you know, a little more, in fact. And spying, indeed, for we have our secret police department, where private information is received. Well, this wild legend belongs to our Middle Ages, not yours, but ours. And no one believes it even among us, except the old ladies of 18 stone. Not your old ladies, I mean, but ours. We've everything you have. I am revealing one of our secrets out of friendship for you, though it's forbidden. This legend is about paradise. There was, they say, here on earth a thinker and philosopher. He rejected everything. Laws, conscience, faith, and above all, the future life. He died. He expected to go straight to darkness and death, and he found a future life before him. He was astounded and indignant. This is against my principles, he said, and he was punished for that. Well, that is, you must excuse me, I'm just repeating what I heard myself. It's only a legend. He was sentenced to walk 250,000 kilometers in the dark. We've adopted the metric system, you know. And when he's finished that quadrillion, the gates of heaven would be open to him and he'll be forgiven. And what tortures have you in the other world besides the 250,000 kilometers? Asked Ivan with a strange eagerness. What tortures? Don't ask. In old days we had all sorts, but now they've taken chiefly to moral punishments, the stings of conscience, all that nonsense. We got that, too, from you, from the softening of your manners. And who's the better for it? Only those who've got no conscience, for how can they be tortured by conscience when they have none? But decent people who have conscience and a sense of honour suffer for it. Reforms, when the ground has not been prepared for them, especially if their institutions copied from abroad, do nothing but mischief. The ancient fire was better. Well, this man, who was condemned to the quadrillion kilometres, stood still, looked round, and lay down across the road. I won't go. I refuse, on principle. Take the soul of an enlightened Russian atheist and mix it with the soul of the prophet Jonah, who sulked for 3 days and nights in the belly of the whale, and you get the character of that thinker who lay across the road. What did he lie on there? Well, I suppose there was something to lie on. You're not laughing? Bravo!
Cried Ivan, still with the same strange eagerness. Now he was listening with an unexpected curiosity.
Well, is he lying there now? That's the point, that he isn't. He lay there almost 1,000 years, and then he got up and went on. What an ass!
Cried Ivan, laughing nervously and still seeming to be pondering something intently. Does it make any difference whether he lies there forever or walks the quadrillion kilometres?
It would take 1 billion years to walk it. Much more than that. I haven't got a pencil and paper. I could work it out. But he got there long ago, and that's where the story begins.
What, he got there? But how did he get 1 billion years to do it?
Why, you keep thinking of our present Earth. But our present Earth may have been repeated 1 billion times. Why, it's become extinct, been frozen, cracked, broken to bits, disintegrated into its elements. Again, the water above the firmament. Then again a comet, again a sun. Again from the sun it becomes Earth, and the same sequence may have been repeated endlessly and exactly the same to every detail. Most unseemly and insufferably tedious. Well, what happened when he arrived? Why, the moment the gates of paradise were open and he walked in, for he'd been there 2 seconds, by his watch. Though to my thinking his watch must have long dissolved into its elements on the way. He cried out that those 2 seconds were worth walking. Not 1 quadrillion kilometres, but 1 quadrillion of quadrillions, raised to the quadrillionth power. In fact, he sang Hosanna, and overdid it so that some persons there of lofty ideas wouldn't shake hands with him at first. He'd become too rapidly reactionary, they said. The Russian temperament. Now, I repeat, it's a legend. I give it for what it's worth. So, that's the sort of ideas we have on such subjects even now. I've caught you,
Ivan cried with an almost childish delight, as though he'd succeeded in remembering something at last. That anecdote about the quadrillion years, I made up myself. I was 17 then. I was at the high school. I made up that anecdote and told it to a schoolfellow called Korovkin. It was in Moscow. The anecdote is so characteristic that I couldn't have taken it from anywhere. I thought I'd forgotten it. But I've unconsciously recalled it. I recalled it myself. It was not you telling it. Thousands of things are unconsciously remembered like that, even when people are being taken to execution. It's come back to me in a dream. You are that dream. You're a dream, not a living creature.
From the vehemence with which you deny my existence, laughed the gentleman, I am convinced that you believe in me.
Not in the slightest. I haven't 1/100th part of a grain of faith in you.
But you have 1/1000th of a grain. Homeopathic doses, perhaps, are the strongest. Confess that you have faith even to 1/10000th of a grain.
Not for 1 minute, cried Ivan furiously. But I should like to believe in you, he added strangely.
Aha! There's an admission. But I am good-natured. I'll come to your assistance again. Listen. It was I caught you, not you, me. I told you your anecdote you'd forgotten on purpose, so as to destroy your faith in me completely.
You're lying. The object of your visit is to convince me of your existence.
Just so. But hesitation, suspense, conflict between belief and disbelief, is sometimes such torture to a conscientious man, such as you are, that it's better to hang oneself at once. Knowing that you are inclined to believe me, I administered some disbelief by telling you that anecdote. I lead you to belief and disbelief by turns, and I have my motive in it. It's the new method. As soon as you disbelieve in me completely, you'll begin assuring me to my face that I'm not a dream but a reality. I know you. Then I shall have attained my object. which is an honourable one, I shall sow in you only a tiny grain of faith, and it will grow into an oak tree, and such an oak tree that, sitting on it, you will long to enter the ranks of the hermits in the wilderness and the saintly women. For that is what you're secretly longing for. You'll dine on locusts. You'll wander into the wilderness to save your soul.
Then it's for the salvation of my soul you're working, is it, you scoundrel?
One must do a good work sometimes. How ill-humoured you are.
Fool, did you ever tempt those holy men who ate locusts and prayed 17 years in the wilderness till they were overgrown with moss?
My dear fellow, I've done nothing else. One forgets the whole world and all the worlds and sticks to one such saint, because he is a very precious diamond. One such soul, you know, is sometimes worth a whole constellation. We have our system of reckoning, you know. The conquest is priceless, and some of them, on my word, are not inferior to you in culture, though you won't believe it. They can contemplate such depths of belief and disbelief at the same moment that sometimes it really seems that they are within a hair's breadth of being turned upside down, as the actor Gorbunov says.
Well, did you get your nose pulled?
Literally, did you get off with a long nose made at you, a proverbial expression in Russia for failure?
My dear fellow,
observed the visitor sententiously,
it's better to get off with your nose pulled than without a nose at all. As an afflicted marquis observed not long ago, he must have been treated by a specialist, in confession to his spiritual father, a Jesuit. I was present, it was simply charming. Give me back my nose, he said, and he beat his breast. My son, said the priest evasively, all things are accomplished in accordance with the inscrutable decrees of Providence, and what seems a misfortune sometimes leads to extraordinary, though unapparent, benefits. If stern destiny has deprived you of your nose, it's to your advantage that no one can ever pull you by your nose. Holy Father, that's no comfort, cried the despairing marquis. I'd be delighted to have my nose pulled every day of my life, if it were only in its proper place. My son, sighs the priest, you can't expect every blessing at once. This is murmuring against Providence, who even in this has not forgotten you. For if you repine, as you repined just now, declaring you'd be glad to have your nose pulled for the rest of your life, your desire has already been fulfilled indirectly, for when you lost your nose, you were led by the nose.
Phew! How stupid! Cried Ivan.
My dear friend, I only wanted to amuse you, but I swear that's the genuine Jesuit casuistry, and I swear that it all happened word for word as I told you. It happened lately and gave me a great deal of trouble. The unhappy young man shot himself that very night when he got home. I was by his side till the very last moment. Those Jesuit confessionals are really my most delightful diversion at melancholy moments. Here's another incident that happened only the other day. A little blonde Norman girl of 20, a buxom, unsophisticated beauty that would make your mouth water, comes to an old priest. She bends down and whispers her sin into the grating. "Why, my daughter, have you fallen again already?" cries the priest. "Oh, Sancta Maria, what do I hear? Not the same man this time. How long is this going on? Aren't you ashamed?" "Ah, mon père," answers the sinner with tears of penitence, "ça lui fait tant de plaisir et à moi si peu de peine." Fancy such an answer. I drew back. It was the cry of nature, better than innocence itself, if you like. I absolved her sin on the spot and was turning to go, but I was forced to turn back. I heard the priest at the grating making an appointment with her for the evening. Though he was an old man, hard as flint, he fell in an instant. It was nature, the truth of nature, asserting its rights. What, you're turning up your nose again, angry again? I don't know how to please you. Leave me alone, you're beating on my brain like a haunting nightmare,
Ivan moaned miserably, helpless before his apparition.
I'm bored with you, agonizingly and insufferably. I would give anything to be able to shake you off. I repeat, moderate your expectations. Don't demand of me everything great and noble, and you'll see how well we shall get on.
said the gentleman impressively.
"You're really angry with me for not having appeared to you in a red glow with thunder and lightning, with scorched wings, but have shown myself in such a modest form. You're wounded, in the first place, in your aesthetic feelings, and secondly, in your